There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Castaway, what's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
So every week we strand a lucky listener or a Dubai bookworm on a desert island with only three books to read. And it's lovely to hear what they choose every single week. With us today is Jonathan Siklos, chairman of Dubai Drama Group, a regular guest discussing matters theatrical on the ticket as well. He's been involved as actor and producer in various productions from Alan Ayckbourn's Relatively Speaking to Shakespeare's Hamlet, which is fitting seeing as the Bard's birthday is coming up this week.
That's right. It's the 23rd of April, I think.
Yes.
Which is not only his birthday, but his death day. So
which seems
tough luck.
Beautifully Shakespearean.
And I think today is Shakespeare's, the day he was baptised.
Uh-huh. Only you would know about his birth.
Yeah. But also, Charlotte Bronte was born on this day. And if we're going into libraries still, the Library of Congress was created on the 24th of April in 1800. So... yeah, another. There's a lot of momentous literary moments.
It's also St. George's Day, Shakespeare's birthday.
All these fun facts coming out.
23rd of April.
Yeah, I was born on what used to be called Empire Day. So, and they always used to put the flags out. And I was fooled by my parents into thinking
thought it was all about
my birthday. And of course it wasn't.
So what's the first book on the pile that you've got with you today?
It's Hamlet, The Tragedy of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark. And this is something that I... know reasonably well because Dubai Drama Group, so which this is the group that I've been running for 3 or 4 years now, put on a production of Hamlet almost exactly a year ago, in fact, to coincide with Shakespeare's birthday.
And it's coming up again.
It's coming up again. Yeah, we're gluttons for punishment. It took us about 7 months to rehearse it, to get it up to scratch. And we liked it so much that we're doing it again. That's not strictly true. I mean, it was a torturous process. learning all of those lines and rehearsing it. But we more feel that since we've got it, we should do it again. And it was an unusual version of the play. So usually it has 22 characters in it, but we did it with just 5 people.
So did you act in it?
Yes.
Were you Hamlet?
Yes.
So can you at some stage give us the to be or not to be? My favourite.
I could.
Yes, yeah. Do you
I
want
could.
To do it now, or do you need to have a moment?
No, I don't need. if you really want, do you want me to do all of it?
No. Up until that makes calamity of so long life.
Okay.
Under pressure.
So let me see. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against the sea of troubles and by opposing, end them. To die. To sleep no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand shocks that flesh is heir to, 'tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep no more. Will that do?
Wonderful. That was brilliant. Brilliant. I just absolutely love it. I mean, I love Shakespeare, full stop. But I think that soliloquy is just the most outstanding. And I mean, it was Hamlet was Shakespeare's longest play.
That's right.
And it is the one that has been most performed, most filmed. It seems to sort of, you know, around the world, it's in translation or what have you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been performed more times than any other Shakespearean play. It's his longest. It's probably had the greatest effect on the English language, a greater effect than any of the other plays. So there are all sorts of things that you don't realise are in Hamlet, but then you hear it, and it's very soundbitey. So, I mean, even if the play is difficult to follow at times, you don't need to go more than a few minutes before you hear something, and it's something that you know from a book you read, or from The Simpsons, or from anything else in popular culture, and you think, my word, that was Hamlet. Mm. I had no idea.
Yeah, and it's there, isn't it? And do you remember when the year of the big anniversary of Shakespeare, and they bought the it was a roving Shakespeare company from the Globe
to
who
Globe.
Performed Hamlet at Duck Tack, and it was an incredible, you know, again, it just brought it all back. I mean, you can see it time and time again, and I think it's fantastic you're doing it again, because you know, you get something different out of each single performance because people put their mark on it. But it is a challenge to just have 5.
It's very hard work indeed. So, I mean, I only had 2 roles. So I had Hamlet and then Bernardo, one of the guards who appears only at the beginning for a little while. And so in a way, this is one unusual in that it's one production where playing Hamlet isn't necessarily the most challenging thing, because some of my some of the other actors had up to six roles, including one guy who had to play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who always appear together.
That's amazing.
They only appear together in the production. And so he had to, the way we differentiated between the characters is through physicality and changes in voices. We didn't have any props. We didn't have any set, and we didn't have any costumes. And so when you're switching from one to the other, you have to change your body and you have to change your voice. But with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, that's line to line to line to line, going backwards and forwards, into and out of postures and voices. And so it kept it very, very snappy indeed, which is what we were going for in the production. So we shortened it to start with. From normal running time, it is about 3.5 hours. We chopped about a third of it out, so to bring it down to just over 2 hours. And we tried to keep it as fast-paced as possible. So, as I mentioned, you don't have to go very long before you hit A, to be or not to be, or frailty, thy name is woman, or to thine own self be true.
Have you got another? Have you got a favourite part of Hamlet? You know, if you, I mean, there are sort of things. It's like King Lear. If for me, it's the end with King Lear that, you know, I just can't bear it. It's so moving.
I have a number of favourite parts. I think the to be or not to be monologue is, I wouldn't say it's one of my favourite parts. It's certainly, I find, the most challenging part.
Read it so beautifully. Well,
thank you very much. I mean, it's extremely abstract, more abstract than some of the other soliloquies. Some of the other famous ones, oh, that this too solid flesh would milk, or what a rogue and peasant slave am I, they're much more descriptive, and you can see the thought process that Hamlet's going through, and he's talking about things that are happening, and so that makes them easier to relate to. But to be or not to be is very, very abstract.
But I got the complete sense of what you were feeling, and you were very emotional as you were saying it.
Well, I was a bit nervous. I've been put on the spot a little bit.
Can I ask our listeners, do you have a favourite Shakespeare play that you always go back to and you think, you know, that was the one I saw as a play or as a film or as an adaptation, or one that you, God forbid, studied at school? Text in 4001. We'd love to hear your thoughts. I mean, I think Hamlet is spectacular, but there are so many others.
I've got a question along the same lines for you, though, Jonathan. I mean, I know you've performed in this production, you've put it together, but why, of all Shakespeare's plays, why does Hamlet speak to you the most?
I am not sure that it does speak to me over and above the others. It's the one I know best. The reason was that the concept was brought to us by somebody who'd done this sort of production, in fact, this exact production, at a professional level, on tour, both in the UK and the US. A resident actress called Annie Northam brought us this play, having seen a Dubai Drama Group production of The Homecoming, which we'd done about a year beforehand. And she saw the three brothers in The Homecoming, and she said, you guys looked like brothers and you looked like you were having fun. So here's something that I've been doing, and I wonder if you'd be interested in it. And so she took the idea to, she brought it to us, and that's how we became, that's how it came to us, really. But because we spent so long with it, that's why I'm so familiar with it. And the reason that I'd want to take it to my desert island as your castaway is that even after 7 months rehearsing it, I still feel that I didn't know it completely, which I think is an incredible thing to say of any piece of work. I mean, I can't imagine spending 7 months studying any other piece of work and feeling that there were bits I still didn't understand, bits are still being revealed to me, and bits that ultimately on stage I had to fudge a little bit because I still didn't quite get them.
I would disagree. I do. I'm sorry to say, I do disagree a lot. I'm really sorry. But for me, it's King Lear. I think that I could read it again and again and again. I could see it again and again with different interpretations. And it's so unbearable. It's a tragedy that almost, I don't think even in whether it was one of those that they said it could never be acted, because it's just so bleak, so dark.
Literary moment, milestones in literary history.
Now, Jonathan, your first book, or play rather, that you had with you was Hamlet. And that's quite fitting, because most historians agree that William Shakespeare was born on the 23rd of April, 1564, which is a couple of days away. He's also thought to have died on the same date, and we were talking about the date of his baptism being today as well, which is the random fact that Isabel happened to know. A question that often comes up when we talk about Shakespeare is how he is still relevant over 400 years after his death. And I think a great way of illustrating that is looking at phrases we use without perhaps even realising that we're quoting Shakespeare. So have you been sent on a wild goose chase? You're taking the words out of Mercutio's mouth in Romeo and Juliet. I must be cruel only to be kind, says Hamlet. Even today, that sentiment doesn't always end well. If you need to lie low, you'd be quoting from Much Ado About Nothing. And Shakespeare was too prolific for our brief literary moment, so all I'm going to do is leave you with a bit of a pop quiz for a chance to win a selection of books from the Emirates Literature Foundation. So which of Shakespeare's plays is the longest? It's one of the ones I've just mentioned, and one that Jonathan's mentioned in particular. A, Romeo and Juliet, B, Hamlet, or C, Much Ado About Nothing. Text in the answer to 4001 with your name, and we'll announce the winner at the end of the show. But now, it's back to this.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
Your next one's an interesting choice, very different to Hamlet. What have you got for your second choice?
My second choice is the book that I've spent more time with than any other, and that is the Hans Weyer Dictionary of Modern Written Arabic.
I'm all for bringing a dictionary to a desert island, because I think that they're wonderful, magical things. But why this one in particular?
Well, I spent about 5 years studying Arabic before I moved to Dubai, which was itself 10 years ago. So I've had the book for 15 years, and over that 5 years of studying Arabic, it rarely left my side. I'd say I looked at it 6 days out of seven each week, was studying for at least an hour or two every single day. And like I was saying with the Hamlet, you can spend so much time with it and still not get to grips with it or still not know it fully. The Hans Weyer Dictionary was still surprising me and amusing me and informing me after 5 years.
Can you explain to our listeners, it's an unusual way of a dictionary being put together, if you're English speaking, because it uses the tri root. So every word in Arabic, or most words in Arabic, have, and if you could explain that simply to our listeners, so you can't look a word up, you can't look up like dissatisfied,
yep,
or whatever in the Arabic equivalent. You have to know the root.
Yeah, there are two humps that you have to get over before you use this dictionary. The first is that you have to learn the Arabic alphabet. So in exactly the same way that there is an English alphabet, there's an Arabic alphabet, and there is an order of letters. And by and large, as a rule of thumb, the words appear in the order of those letters. But there is each Arabic word, or most Arabic words, have three root letters.
Like dhahaba.
Dhahaba is, means to go, simply, or he went in the past tense like that. But then you can add additional letters to them. So let me think of another example. So sabaha is to swim. Masbah is the place where the swimming happens, or the pool. So you would need to know about a word like masbah, that you would take off the m at the beginning to get those three root letters, sa, ba, and ha. And then you would look up those letters
under
in those orders. Sa, ba, ha. Exactly. Under sa, then under ba, then under ha.
So that was the challenge for me, was getting my head around that. So I would look up what the first letter of the word I wanted to know. It wouldn't be in that order. And so it was, as you said, you've got to get into the Arabic language to be able to use this dictionary. But it is an amazing dictionary.
It really is. And what it helps you to appreciate is that the language, classical Arabic, is remarkably structured. So there's no such thing as an irregular verb. And what happens with these three root letters is that different, let's say, filters are applied to them. So the first form is just the three letters pronounced with equal weight, let's say, so like sa, ba, ha. The second form has a doubled second letter. The third form has a long first letter. And you learn these forms, and the different forms do different things to the meaning of the word. So in theory, as long as you know what the original three root letters mean, and you understand the shape of the word, the form of it, you can work out what it means. And that's something that cannot be said for a lot of other languages. So as long as you invest the time early on understanding the way the language works, the structure of the words, then after a while, it really opens up to you.
And then if you know a word, you can, as you say, you can work out other forms of that word. You will sort of hear them within language. But sometimes they take quite weird where they've come from, what the root is, and actually what the end, the...
Yeah, yes, exactly. I mean, so I can give an example. There's another word, akada, which means to be complex or to be complicated. And the adjective from that is muakkad, which would mean complicated, but it could also mean tortuous or thorny or knotty. Hmm. And another form of the word akad means a knot.
Yes, so, but if you take a simpler one, and actually very literary, so kutuba, mm-hmm. okay, and take us through the different words we could get from that.
Well, there, I mean, that page, the section on kutuba will go on for pages and pages in the dictionary.
So what does it mean in English?
To write. So kutuba literally means he wrote.
And a katib?
Is a bookshop. Is that right?
A writer.
A writer, yeah, katib, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Then maktab would be a
yes.
bookshop.
Yeah.
But then there is kitab, there's maktub,
there's
something written.
Yeah, there's so many. It's so fascinating. Once you start to understand, and you can do it with virtually any word in Arabic, you can find the root, and then you can see the sort of, the whole thing. It'll be pages and pages, as you say, in the dictionary, that follow that three-letter root.
But then, I mean, even from that route, there are some really unusual words, and you can't see how they get back to the original, to the original root. So, I mean, I'm simplifying this a little bit and making it sound like it's totally rigorous. But then, all of a sudden, you get a curveball, you get a word that has no relation whatsoever to its root, and you're stumped.
Yes,
but that's
yeah.
the beauty of Arabic.
Yeah, it is. It's a wonderful language. I mean, and it is. It took me quite some time, a bit like a SEO trot and tortoise. It took me quite some time to actually get my head around that. But I think so. I assume the desert island you're going to be on is going to be filled with Arabic speakers, so that you will need this hands fare.
I don't know. Do you know, I'm not even sure you do. I mean, most of my time with Hans Vare has just been me and Hans Vare, just the two of us, spending some quality time together. And that's why I can read and write the language quite well, but my ear for it is not brilliant, because I spent most of my time studying the written form of it. So I think if it were just me on the desert island and Hans Vare, we'd be happy. Perhaps I could tell you about some of my favourite words in the dictionary, because there are, if you look through it and if you keep hunting, there are some very peculiar things. And so this was written by Hans Vare, who was a German Arabist and intellectual who was born, lived throughout the 20th century, who was born at the beginning of the 20th century and died in 1981. The first version of this dictionary came out in 1961. And it was updated three or four times. I have the fourth edition, which is the most popular one. So he wrote it in German. And then a guy called...
In 1952. It was published in 1952 in German.
Exactly.
And then
it was translated by J.M. Cowan. And so that's the version, which is the most popular.
He was not an Arabist. That's what I found quite bizarre. He was, you know, completely... He was an American who was... and that's about the only thing he's known for.
Exactly.
It was quite strange.
So there are some very peculiar words in it. And amongst my favourite are tabagdada, which means to swagger or to throw one's weight around, and comes from the root, the same root as Baghdad or Baghdad. So the implication there is that somebody from Baghdad is the sort of person who swaggers or throws their weight around or has a certain sense of braggadocio.
Mm. And that's where braggadocio comes from, potentially.
Potentially, yeah, there we are. And another favourite of mine is tahutlara, which is to behave like or imitate Hitler.
So that was a later addition.
Exactly. So that's a good example of how a word has been subsumed into the dictionary. So you can hear the hutlara, and then you have the second form of the verb, which makes it tahutlara.
I'm sure that drywell didn't make it. Or pipe feeder. So when I came to Dubai, a driver was called drywell and a pipe feeder was a plumber. But pipe feeder.
Well, it may well be. Yeah, yes. There being no P in the Arabic.
Yes.
So all P's become B's. Like Bipsy, everyone's favourite cola drink. And my last favourite is sabar, which means to insert one's finger into a chicken to ascertain whether or not it is going to lay an egg.
Well, I mean,
again.
So there we are. There's a word for everything.
Yeah, that was probably also could be used in a quite a derogatory term, but we won't go down there. So I think you could certainly entertain yourself and educate yourself on your desert island with the Hans Vair Arabic dictionary.
Very much so.
And also, you know, as good as any book to keep you entertained. You'd never be bored.
Castaway, what's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
So we've heard your first two choices already. Remind us what those were.
So my first choice was The Tragedy of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark by... Who's it by again?
Oh, that old guy. Will.
William Shakespeare.
Will something.
And which is the play I've spent most time with. My second choice was The Hans Vair Dictionary of Modern Written Arabic, which is the book I've spent the most time with. And my third choice is Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections, which is the novel I've read the most times.
Now, this is a novel that I've heard about probably the most times and have never read. So would you mind telling us a little bit about it? I know it's about a Midwestern family.
It is.
And that's about it.
It is. The Corrections is about a troubled family living in troubled times. So it's set at the turn of the century. It's set between the Midwest and the East Coast of America. And is about Alfred and Enid Lambert, who are an elderly couple, and they are very unhappily married, and they have three grown-up children who are each unhappy in their own different ways. So the eldest one is an outwardly successful bank manager with a beautiful family, who is, like his father, struggling with depression and feelings of paranoia that his wife and children are ganging up on him. The middle child, Chip, is... a successful or formerly successful academic who lost his career after falling in love with a student. And the youngest of the three children dropped out of college, became a chef, and married a man twice her age. So The Corrections is Jonathan Franzen's vision of family life in America at the end of the 20th century.
What I love about the synopsis that I've read is that it tracks them from the mid-20th century up until this big kind of reunion, this one family Christmas.
One last Christmas.
And which seems like it must be the kind of climax, the heated moment of the book.
That's right. And the Christmas is something that the matriarch of the family has been looking forward to. It's what she looks forward to every year. And it's what she really places all of her hopes upon. So her own personal home life is fairly... is not in good shape, let's just say that. Her husband is struggling with Parkinson's. She is unable to manage the house which she's lived in for 40 or 50 years. She's more or less estranged from her children, who all have their own problems. Yet she's still pinning all of her hopes on Christmas, which is not what it used to be. She's imagining the Christmas of 30 years ago, when her children would come and sit under the tree, and that's what she's trying to recreate, which is, of course, a hopeless position. But the book moves from telling the story of all of the main five characters in the book, really their backstories, their lives, and they converge on this one final Christmas in the fictional town of St. Jude in the Midwest.
I mean, there have been lots of novels about troubled families, and a lot of them are brilliant. What sets this one apart from others that you've read?
It's how real the characters are. So I've lost track of how many times I've read it, perhaps five or six times, and it's a big book. And the characters, all of the characters, Alfred and Enid and the three children, are real to me, very, very real to me, to the extent that I can't imagine this ever being made into a film. I would be bound to be disappointed by it, mm-hmm. because the characters are so incredibly real to me. And what Jonathan Franzen has done, he's done a number of things. What he's done so brilliantly is to get people to identify with the characters and the situations. So although my family is nothing like the Lambert family in The Corrections, I can read about Denise, the matriarch, arguing with her daughter, and I think, my word, that's my sister and my mum arguing. Mm. He's got such a good ear for dialogue that you identify with it.
So was there a favourite character? I mean, because they all sound quite troubled, and sometimes it's hard to like, unless you feel there's some redemption in it. So did you have a favourite character in The Corrections?
Well, there's redemption of a sort for all of them, in a way. I mean, this is what The Corrections of the title refers to. It's a reference to the dot-com bubble bursting in the global economy, and the fact that the economy had to go through what was termed at the time a correction. But it's also the personal corrective journeys of the five characters in it, and how they also are effectively off their true path and need to correct themselves onto it. I identified with all of the characters. I mean, as difficult as this may be to, I mean, almost equally, they're incredibly well drawn. They're all deeply flawed, but he provokes such a, or inspires such sympathy for all of them. And they're all so terribly down on their luck, whilst outwardly seeming pretty sorted.
Now, this won the 2001 National Book Award for Fiction in the US. And then there was a bit of a PR nightmare for Jonathan Franzen, because Oprah Winfrey, in her wisdom for her book club, so loved this book that she chose it. And then he refused. He felt this was dumbing down, and that it was a commercialization of his literary book. And so she withdrew the invitation. And I'm sure his publishers must have been beside themselves. What do you think?
I think that was a little unfortunate. I think that Jonathan Franzen rightly sees himself as a highbrow literary figure, and that being part of the Oprah Book Club was not quite the thing for his clientele, which I think in retrospect was probably a mistake for commercial reasons, but also a mistake for some of the reasons that I've mentioned, that I think this book speaks to everybody who reads it. I think everybody can identify something of themselves in the characters, and something of their family in the Lambert family.
And so, also, I think it's pretentious of anyone, I mean, not to think that his book's literary. He's, I'm sure it is, but to think that that literature, high literature or literature of any kind, is not for the masses. You know, Charles Dickens didn't take that view when he was writing. I mean, he was appealing to everyone, and you know, it was followed by people from all walks of life. And you know, I think Oprah, over the years on her book club, has had such an outstanding diversity of books that there will be something there for everyone.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was a bit of a bum note, and I think it was smoothed over, and I think he and Oprah are friends again now. But I suspect there was a little bit of ego in that decision. And he's trying to do, and has indeed done, something quite spectacular with this book. I mean, he is writing about nothing less than the state of the American family at the turn of the century. That's a big topic. And with his two subsequent books, which are the same sort of length of this or longer, he's doing similar things. He's talking about the state of American society.
I've heard people talk about the publication date of it being kind of odd or significant in a way as well, because it came out on the 1st of September 2001. And a lot of people, because obviously a few days later we had 9/11, a lot of people associated some of the sentiments in the corrections with the sentiments that were surrounding America at the time as well.
Yeah, some people have said that it's a prophetic book, not in the sense that it prophesied the 9/11 attacks. I think more that it captured the national sentiment at the time, a feeling of unease. And it was immediately, I mean, it's about a recession, so people are going to be unhappy and unsettled. I think there's a little bit of, a little bit of hindsight at work there, that people associate it with the attacks and feel that there's a sort of eerie connection between the two things. But I think it's just of its time. I mean, I think it's a minor work of genius. He really has captured something and put it down in a way that no one else was able to at the time.
And you think it will endure?
I think it'll definitely endure. I mean, I think even taken out of the context in which it exists, it's brilliant. It's. I mean, I was reading it or rereading bits of it yesterday and this morning as well, and just getting completely sidetracked, completely stuck into it. His stories and his sentences. Some of them go on for pages, but they're so funny, so well constructed. That it's impossible not to get sucked into it, even if you took it out of the context of early 21st century America, read it completely in isolation, it's still entertaining.
Mm. And I think, you know, having that marker in fiction of that time, in the way that Dickens did, in the way that Thomas Hardy did, in the way that John Steinbeck did with The Grapes of Wrath, you know, those books are fantastic to actually let you get into that time and space and people and how they felt, because it moves on all the time. We're sort of, you know, living in a different world.
What will be interesting is to look back on it. I mean, it's already 17 years old. It'll be interesting to look back on it in 20 or 30 years, and I think it will be as much as a good novel, a historical document.
Mm. And what do you read a lot of, say, 20th century classics? Do you have sort of a favourite?
I do like 20th century classics, particularly American fiction. So this one, for me is amongst the best. I like Steinbeck and F. Scott Fitzgerald, yeah, and all
the
of
Great
the things,
Gatsby.
The Great Gatsby, all of the things I was supposed to read when I was doing GCSE English, but didn't, and then came back to reading them as a young adult, yeah, and realised why they were on the syllabus.
But actually, sometimes it's better not to have to study them. Wasn't The Great Gatsby the best book of all time from one of our authors at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature?
I can't remember.
100 books, and it
Robert
was...
Robert McCrum?
Yeah, Robert McCrum. I think that was... I'm sure someone said that to me. That The Great Gatsby was the best book, you know.
It's funny what you said about when you were studying GCSE literature, you didn't read them, then you came back to them and you did. Because whenever we have these conversations with castaway guests, often a big part of why they've chosen a book is timing. And the books that we fall in love with are largely part of when we read them and how we felt at the time, how old we were when we read them and the circumstances around that. When was the first time that you read this?
I read it at the end of a six-month around the world tour in between my undergraduate degree and my master's degree, which is when I started studying Arabic. So it was a particular time. I was sort of taking stock of my situation and looking forward to something. And so I read it over a few weeks somewhere between New Zealand and the Cook Islands.
And this is the book that Jonathan's talking about. It's The Corrections by another Jonathan Franzen.
Jonathan.
Yeah, your namesake. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it was published, obviously, probably 2000.
2001.
That was it, 2001. Yeah. And it won the award
National Book Award.
Yes,
yeah.
So a very, very highly rated book. And great to have your personal recommendation, because I think for listeners that word of mouth recommendation really helps.
It's always good to recap all the titles, because Jane's asked about what the title of this one was, which is The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen, but remind us of the other two that you spoke about earlier as well.
So the three that I'd take with me to my desert island would be The Tragedy of Hamlet, The Prince of Denmark, of course otherwise known as Hamlet, by Shakespeare. The second book would be The Hans Weyer Dictionary of Modern Written Arabic. And the third one we just talked about is The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen.
Thank you, Jonathan, so much for coming on the show. As a castaway guest, we release you off the island now.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.